Hi, folks. Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. A member of the primary purpose group of AA of Southern Pines, North Carolina. And my sobriety date is February 2nd of 57. And I'm delighted to be here again. I'm the oldest rat among the rat pack of speakers. And so that's why they put me on first. They weren't sure if I'd live long enough to make it till Sunday. And so they get the old guy out of the way. And, had a complaint from Minnesota. Is that out of everybody's eyes now? And I still use the Braille system. It really is good to be here, I think. We never had the screaming memes across the street. I'm just delighted that we're going to have the spiritual meeting in the spiritual mecca of Alcoholics Anonymous in Whiskey Beach. And just something powerfully significant about that. And so we'll wander in the desert here for a few days, and then we'll be home Sunday morning. That is absolutely unreal. We're going to have a good time here. Is that still working? It's me. All of a sudden it went dead. We are going to have a great time. I know all of the folks that are speaking. It really is going to be good. I know all that bunch, and they're good friends, and they're fine members of AA. Got a great guy for history. He's the only one in the bunch that can report first person on what happened in the relics of the history of AA. And so I'm really glad Cliff's here. It makes me feel sprightly. What I'm supposed to do is get us dumbed down and anchored as we start to launch into to a spiritual high. And that'll be my job, to sort of keep it down to earth. I was thinking, if it's possible, it sounds a little bit sacrilegious, but it is possible, I believe, to get lost in the book, so that we get to thinking the book is the way of life, that we live in the Holy Grail, and don't recognize that the book is about how to get out and get with it in life. And I know people that are just absolutely brilliant about the book that couldn't cross the street without an escort. I was sponsored, forgive the reference, but I was sponsoring a very bad Yankee a while back from New York, worst kind. Yeah, I knew it. Hear it from the Brooklyn side. No, good buddies there. But there is just kind of an edge to New York people. You don't have to tell you where they're from. You know as soon as you meet them where they're from. As I was sponsoring this guy, trying to, and it was almost like sponsoring the Energizer Bunny. Yeah, he was just jumping all over the place. And he just went from one crisis to another. So he called me up one day, and he had his crisis of the month. And I don't remember what it was. He probably doesn't either. And it was just absolutely one of those live-or-die situations. He said, man, I got to talk with you, and I need to do it now. And I said, well, okay, come on over. So he comes in, and he goes into the histrionics about the latest misadventure. And when he got toward the end, he said, where do you think I ought to be working in the book? And I said, nowhere. And he said, startled, what do you mean? Aren't all the answers in the book? I said, well, of course the answer's in the book. But I'll tell you something, Tiger. You know more about that book at 3 o'clock in the morning than I do at high noon. The book isn't about knowing the book. It's about living the life that's laid out in the book. So you don't need to learn any more stuff. You need to put it into your life. And so that's what I'm talking about. Thank you for that applaud. That was a rousing ovation. Me and you, the only ones. I'm glad you're alert, girl. But that's true. I mean, you can get so caught up in it, you think that's it. And it's a textbook. That's like thinking a textbook is an education. Ain't nothing till you use it. And so, anyway, it can happen like that. It can happen in steps. Yeah, I know some people in program many, many years who do steps in perpetuity. I mean, it's just sort of a repetitious practice, and they're free to do that. But it can be a velvet trap. I think probably the best delineation, this part of my dumbing down process, part of the delineation of that is in the well quoted now preface to the 12 and 12, where it says something like this: our steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life will expel the obsession to drink. It'll cast that sucker out. It will expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. To me, that's an important message. That is not about mechanically working on me ad nauseum. It's about getting to a point that I can practice the program of recovery as a way of life. I don't mechanically work steps. I live steps. I live by the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I live by these principles. And usually when I visit a step to study, it's when I'm getting ready to do a workshop or something, just to make sure I still remember what's written in there. But otherwise, it's about a way of life. And it's not about getting into studying me and fixing me from now on. You know, it's about a whole different outcome, and that's how to become a maximum service usefulness in God's world. And so that's one of the reasons that, you know, I always approach intensive work in the book with some mixed feelings about whether we over-romance that and at the expense of getting into the real delivery of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So with that caveat, then, we'll get into studying intently what we're going to do here. Let me take it one notch further, a little different direction. We have podium problems. We have everything sliding off here but me. I made some notes that I wanted to use with making this point. Well, I know I made them. Oh, yeah. Looking at the steps in the context of where they came from, looking at the involvement people with us in putting this program together and in carrying this program out. You know, there's some things that I think are awfully, awfully important that sort of undergird and lay the foundation for what our program is all about. And I think about, you know, naturally to where the founder came from, and the story is well known, but I'll recite it again. And it's that well-described thing where Ebby, the guy that Bill called his sponsor till the day he died, he was a strange sponsor. I mean, he was sponsor when he was conscious, and that was not too frequently. But in looking at where we came from and what it was that led to the formation of this program and where the steps came from, you know, it's real kind of telling to me that story about Bill, you know, and when he got through of his annex and he was just falling apart and he was shaken to death and he was in that hovel in Brooklyn, and Ebby came knocking at his door. He called him and he came knocking at his door. Bill delighted to see him because he knew an old drinking buddy was back and it would be on. And Ebby came in and he was looking too good to believe. And Bill looked him over and asked him what had happened to him. And he said, "I've got religion." And that was scary to Bill because Bill's party was suddenly canceled. And he knew that he'd be a one-man party if he had one. And so he sat and talked with Abby. And then Abby explained to him about what had happened. And in the course of that explanation, Abby made a comment, and he probably didn't know how telling that comment would be. But he said, when he talked about getting religion, and then Bill responded by saying, "That's not in my league. That is not something I can handle. I'm not the religious type." And then Abby said some words that were to be prophetic in this program and critically important. And what he said to Bill was, "Why don't you choose your own conception of God?" And that started the ball rolling. Now, it didn't look like it probably that day, but it was a telling thing in the formation of our steps and how they took shape and how they're flavored. And then right below that, there's another thing that I noted, that it's only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was requested of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point upon a foundation of complete willingness. I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. And that was an awfully significant point in AA that really generated one of the founding principles of this program, I believe. And it was the kind of thing that opened the door for me, because had it not been for that exact kind of language, I would have never stayed here. I would have never been able to stay here, because religion was not in my repertoire of things that I was involved in. And so people like that, when we think about, sometimes when we talk about the steps, we make it sound like Bill went up on the mountain and brought down the stone tablets. And not exactly the case. Really kind of we don't talk about it a whole lot, but it was a little bit of a snap job. Now, when it came time to write the steps, we had six of them pretty well in place, plagiarized from the Oxford group with full credit. But the steps are essentially the formation of our 12 steps. And then what Bill did was take those steps and expand on them. And so when I think about that interaction of the formation around the steps and the people that were involved, here we got a totally unsuccessful alcoholic who was never a winner in this program. He never had recovery. He had periods of survival. I met Abby. I hate to admit I'm that old clip, but I met Abby, and he was not a handsome beast. I swear, that boy. I mean, you could diagnose that sucker a block away. He looked like a drunk, and he talked like a drunk. He was a drunk. But intermittently, he'd come up for air, you know, in the course of it, he did that good work with Bill. But beginning with him, you know, that our interaction with people who flavored our steps, who flavored the development of our core program in this deal. And think with me about some of the folk, and God knows you could catalog a ton of them. I just jotted some in a hurry. I didn't think I was ever going to get here. You ever tried to leave Las Vegas in rush hour with a Texan that doesn't know where he's going? My spiritual program got good exercise. but here we slid in. And I've just jotted down a few people that were instrumental in helping us hold this thing together till it started to take form and substance in the person of the steps. And just a few that I jotted down. Ed Dowling, that little Catholic priest who came to Bill's house on that rainy Friday night and said, "I want to talk with you." And that was a telling moment, because Ed became a fast friend of this program and of Bill, and a significant figure in the development of this thing. Sam Shoemaker. You know, I had the privilege, God, I'm confessing to my age, I had the privilege of hearing Sam Shoemaker speak. And what a powerful man, what a powerful example, and what a great friend to Alcoholics Anonymous in those struggling years. Henrietta Seiberling. Remember her? Remember, here's a figures of it, to say it mildly, an upper class lady in the city of Akron, and she gets a drunk on the phone who wants to help another drunk, and she had enough spiritual oomph, insight, and knowledge to say, well, I think I know somebody we can get. Had it not been for Henrietta Seiberling, that date would have probably had a much different kind of look than it did. And what a tremendously important thing that was in our coming together. Tonk, that pastor who answered the phone when Bill was making that call, that historic call, of saying to somebody in language this world had never heard, I'm a drunk from New York and I need another drunk to talk to. That would have sounded goofy to the average citizen. It would have sounded goofy to me. I thought, well, you got anything to drink? Yeah, man, I'll be right over. Yeah, but this guy had the moxie and he had the connection to make something happen. I tell you something, if you... I know that many of you have been. If you haven't been to Akron, if you haven't been, if Gail can tell you, oh, there she is. Gail can tell you about it, and she can tell you all of the ways to get through and get everything done quickly and effectively. But I'd been going to Akron for a few years, never had been into the Mayflower Hotel, you know, where Bill made that phone call to Tonk. And it started the ball rolling that culminated with us being here tonight. And I never had been in there, but I was making a tour, going around. This was before Dr. Bob's House or any of that stuff. And the Mayflower was not open to free-flowing traffic. And so I'm down there with an enterprising young alcoholic. And he said, you want to go in the Mayflower? I said, you can't, man. It's closed. He said, watch this. I knew something was coming. And so this cagey drunk waited till somebody came out, reached over, grabbed the door. Here we go. We walked in. And if you go to Akron, let me implore you to do something that will fit you similar to what I did, because it was a special moment in my life. You know, I was a guy, you know, I've always been a reader and could visualize what was happening in Alcoholics Anonymous in those days, and I came in far enough back that a lot of the actions of those days were still very, very much alive and well and underway. And when I walked in there, that was a special moment for me. I didn't have any conversation with the guy. He just told me where the phone booth was, and he told me what the other place. And back then, there'd been nothing done to memorialize the place. And so I'm standing in, it's not the lobby as we know it, but we call it the mezzanine, the kind of a next level up where the action happened. And so we're standing there, and you know this virtual reality we talk about a lot now, you know, of sort of bringing something alive. I'm looking at this, and I started to relive what I felt that Bill lived that vital day. I didn't have to use a lot of imagination because I've been in exactly that spot. I mean, not that hotel, but I've been in that spot where I absolutely didn't want to drink and yet I was going to drink. And in the balance, you know, I never had the insight or wisdom or inspiration to make a phone call. And I always went into the bar. So I didn't have to imagine what that felt like, to stand there by the door and listen to the clinking glass and know the ease and comfort that comes from a few drinks, eh? Yeah. And so that's what Bill was doing. And I did, a role played in a way, I did what I truly believed Bill did that day. I went over and stood by that, what had been the bar. It was then some kind of an office. But I tell you, I don't care what you do to a bar, that sucker's going to be a bar. I mean, you put an altar in there and a baptismal, but it's still going to be a bar. I don't care what to do to Whiskey Pete's. That sucker is always going to be Whiskey Pete's. And so I stand there and I'm feeling the feeling that Bill felt, because I know that feeling. I know that desperation. I know that hanging on in crisis that you couldn't explain to anybody. I knew that. And then I took the walk he took, where he went across that lobby, back and forth, from the phone to the bar. What shall I do? And then he made that fateful call. And I relived that experience. And when I relived it, the hair stood up on the back of my neck. And because what I realized that day, and the clear thought in my mind, was that my very life suspended from the actions that Bill Wilson took that day, and Tonk, and Cyberly, had he not taken those actions. And I would go so far as to say that the lives of every one of us hung by that slender thread of hope that was generated by one desperate alcoholic and some loving friends who understood at least enough to take some action. Yeah, I was up there a while back. I had the, they said it was a high privilege. I had some doubts for a moment. I spoke at the Saturday night meeting one year at Founders Day was held in a new ball stadium downtown. Akron, Ohio's got to be the coldest place on the planet in June. I had on a thin suit. I mean thin. And I about froze to death. That stadium sounded like an echo chamber, man. They asked me what I thought later. I said, please don't do that anymore. My God, don't do it. But the thing that was overwhelming and overwhelmed the conditions was that in the background I could see the Mayflower Hotel. And those thoughts were very much alive in my life. And so when I think about that kind of a thing, and by all means, if you ever get an opportunity, for God's sakes, do it. It is well worth, anyway, well worth the trip. So vital, vitally important people who played such a major role in that getting going in this thing. Remember a guy named William Silkworth? Yeah, I almost want to call him a third founder. Because, good God, can you imagine what it was that Bill was fortunate enough, and you and I were fortunate enough, for Bill to have a physician who could look at him in a condition where I've been in that condition a lot of times, but I had a different kind of source of energy. You know, with DTs, you know, I've had a lot of times when I was babbling stuff kind of like Bill might have been. And usually when I babbled, they'd put a net on me or something and put me in a soft wall room. But here, Bill had a physician wise enough to recognize something important had happened. And you remember those words he said, I don't know what happened to you, Bill, but whatever it is, you better hang on to it because it sure beat what you had. Thank God for people like that who had the insight, the wisdom, the concern to give us that guidance and support in those early tenuous days. And the last one is Firestone. Yeah, he didn't help us write the principles except in one way. He was the guy that introduced us to this principle of self-support. And what a tremendous service that man did. Well, that's just a few people that come to mind who helped form the principles that we live by in Alcoholics Anonymous today. And I was, when I came here, I was a guy that was not a ready-made, that'll be the shortest second step to say it in a hurry, in history. When I came here, I was a guy who was not a real good candidate for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I dare say that what I'm going to share with you, you probably could share something similar to me. I had some enormous barriers that stood in the way of my engaging in the program. Just having a devastated life was not enough to overcome the barriers. But there were enormous barriers that were there that would stand in the way of any kind of growth into a new life or surrender from the old. One was a willingness to live. You know, I was a guy whose life had been so absolutely much of a loser trail that there was nothing redeeming about it. Yeah, I couldn't think of anything that was worthy in my entire life. I had been responsible, as many of you know, I'd been responsible for the deaths of two people that happened when I was in an alcoholic blackout. And so I had a legacy not only of shame in terms of my performance, but of unbelievable remorse and shame for having committed such a tragic thing in life. And what that produced, all of that culminated in a guy that, my first deal was not whether to be sober, not whether to be spiritual, but whether to live. Because I absolutely felt guilty with every breath I took. I was ashamed to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not because I was too good, because I was too bad. And so, huge barrier, you know, that was essential to get through before anything was apt to happen. Overwhelming sense of guilt was a barrier, a real barrier, so full of guilt and shame that I couldn't ask anybody for help. My God, you know, that was just what would have been unthinkable for anything like that. Overwhelming sense of guilt. And not a motivating factor at all. Ignorance of the illness. I knew absolutely nothing about alcoholism. Now, a lot of people thought I did because a lot of them thought I had it. But I wasn't one of the crowd. You know, every time I'd ever been captured in my life, and I got captured a lot of times, in a lot of forms, in hospitals and psych wards and jails and marriages and, you know, all of the pitfalls of alcoholism. And every time I got captured by anybody, learned scientist or fellow human, I was always found to be not a real fancy catch by any of them. But always diagnosed me as alcoholic. That didn't mean a thing to me. Now, I came into AA just behind when the American Medical Association started to emerge and make sounds like alcoholism is an illness or a disease. And that had just started. But you can hurry up and believe that just because the American Medical Association uttered something didn't change any belief patterns in this country. Alcoholism, when I came into AA, was a moral issue. Universally, the moral issue. It wasn't a sickness. There was nothing wrong with alcohol. It was sorry. It was a moral issue with me. When I first started sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, people talking about AA being, alcoholism being an illness, I found that an almost embarrassing, awkward concept. Now, what on earth is an illness about getting drunk? It made no sense to me. So I was absolutely, I knew possibly two alcoholics with all the people I drunk with. One of them was a guy named Black Cat, wasn't his name, but every drunk gets named something. And his name was Black Cat McGinnis. And first time I ever heard the word alcoholic, I knew that's what he was. Yeah, whatever it was, he was it. And that guy, he was lived in my neighborhood when I was just a little boy. And he was just a bad drunk. And when he'd get drunk, he'd go into DTs. He'd wander around the neighborhood. And he was always talking about seeing big black cats, balls of fire, stuff like that. Us kids used to follow him around. It was the best entertainment in town. We'd follow Black Cat, see what he's going to do next. You know, and he's performing his tricks in town. But I knew he was an alcoholic. And the other one was a guy from Illinois. I start saying his name, but he's got to be dead. But in case he's not, even if not, I'm not going to tell on him anyway. But he had a weird name. And bad drunk, God knows. He and I were on extra duty one time in the Army, and they were having him mow the grass. And they had him chained to a post. I mean, just like a cow. They had him chained on a post because he'd run if he got loose. Well, I'm standing in an office building feeling superior about, well, at least they don't have to chain me up. They wouldn't even let me out of the building. I always think, would it be something if that guy's over somewhere in the Midwest tonight saying, you know, I didn't know but one alcoholic in my life. It was a guy named Ivester. That's... I knew he was an alcoholic. But I mean, that, none of that stuff fit me. I didn't a bit more believe I was an alcoholic. That's a huge barrier. It's hard to get hungry for a solution to a problem you don't have. And so it was a real barrier to this thing. I had a great fear that it might work. I really did. I was 24 years old when I got here. And I thought, well, my God, what if this thing kicks in and works? Here I'm going to be stuck with sober for a long time, maybe. I mean, come on, man. That was not appealing. I thought, what on earth do people do who don't drink? I mean, you talk about dumb, glum, and boring. I could not imagine about what you would do if you didn't drink. And when I got into the program and I started having some inklings that it might actually work, it's scary. I was in AA about 2 years. I don't know if anybody's ever experienced this or not, but about 2 o'clock in the morning one night, I was awake, and I realized all at once that I was actually going to be able to stay sober for the rest of my life if I wanted. And it scared me. And I'm thinking, what if it works? You know, what do you do? I mean, I didn't have any particular problems with a highly active social life at the time. I was locked up. I won't go into too much of that thing. As you sort of crash and burn, you lose a lot of your sort of manly instincts. And over time, as a rule, they'll come back. And that's good news, but it's not real good news if you're locked up. And if you have an interest in life, but I never was too interested in getting into any intimate relationship with any of those dudes I was locked up with. I wasn't sure whether I'd be pitching or catching, and I was a little choosy about that. And Tommy sober didn't sound like great fun to me, and I was afraid it might work. I remember one time people used to pat me an awful lot. I was a young member. I'm an incredibly young guy. I never saw another young member for the first probably 5 or 6 years I was in AA. I heard about them, but I never saw any of them. They must have had them in captivity somewhere, because I never saw any. All I saw was a bunch of weaseled up old gophers. People would say, "Oh my God, your son, how old are you?" And I'd say, "Well, I'm 24. Aren't you lucky? Yeah, man, I'm on a real roll. You know, I am really lucky. God, how lucky can you get? I remember one time, a nice old man was probably 30 or 40 years old. He was patting me on the head, you know, and he telling me how wonderful it was that I was sober at 24. And he said, "Do you realize that you could actually look forward to as much as 50 years of sobriety?" And when he said it, I mean, he just looked like he was just going to go into some kind of rapture or something. It's like Benny Hinn hit him. He was going to fall out and kick. Well, while he's in a rapture, I'm thinking to myself, my God, 50 years, what if it works? And I tell you something, I know there's some fairly new people here. If you got mixed feelings about it, you better get out while you can. You don't. You stay here too long, man, you're here for life. And so, huge barrier, eh? Huge barrier to get going in this thing. Youth, I think, was built into what I just said. Being young is not an illness, but it's a doggone handicap, I tell you, when you're trying to get sober as a young guy. You know, the worst thing for young people is other young people. That peer pressure is just enormous. And so I think I was blessed in that I got sober with a bunch of old weenies they taught me some very, very important things, and I've been a mainline member of Alcoholics Anonymous ever since. But anyway, youth was not a real asset to have. Total lack of spiritual anything. I mean, a total lack. I was the guy who shut down on organized religion before I ever started school, because I got introduced to that fervor of the Bible Belt. For many people, it works. I was not one of them. I was one who found that anything but a warm and welcoming, appealing thing. I found it frightening, and I found it just unbelievable. And as a small boy, I realized that there were things about something as fearsome as God that I didn't believe. I just flat didn't believe. That's a pretty heavy weight to carry around when you're a youngster that can't even spell it, and you've already got active, living doubts about it. That's an interesting thing to carry around. Not a great asset when you're looking at Alcoholics Anonymous. So, a total lack of a spiritual life. Fear and self-centeredness. I think if I had to rename alcoholism, I would rename it self-centered fear, because that's the heart and soul of what this whole thing was about with me, was that sort of self-focused, fearful existence of anything and any engagement in this thing called life. So self-centered fear was an extremely, extremely difficult kind of thing. Closely associated to that was isolation. Yeah, I was a guy who was extremely isolated. And well, you wouldn't have known it if you watched me in action. Yeah, I was the kind of guy that a little pop skull would loosen me up and turn me loose. And I was a guy that was always the life of the party, the town clown. I was always a guy that was starting something and getting stuff going. But all of that was the product of what booze did to free me from that bondage of isolation and fear. And so those are not real attributes for getting into Alcoholics Anonymous. In our book, you know, that's a long introduction, but in our book it gets to some real essence in that, in terms of, you know, here I am as a 24-year-old guy. I'm sitting in a penitentiary. I'm listening to discussion about a way of life that was so foreign to me, it was unimaginable. And what was going through my mind? In that conversation that Bill and Abby were having, and when he said, "Why don't you choose your own conception of God?" That was a tremendously important thing for me. And then right below that, it was just a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Yeah, I am so grateful that we do not have stringent entrance requirements for AA. We do no reference checks. AA is the only place I know where the worse your record, the better your welcome. It's a darn truth. I mean, my God, you come in here just a routine, you know, garden variety drunk, they say, "Oh, well, nice to have you." Let's say I come in here and say, "Well, I'm axe murderer and I just got out of Quentin," and so on. "Yeah, man, come on in. Yeah, we're glad to have you. You'll liven up the party." It's a weird thing. But there's a lot of truth to it. And getting started in that program, as simple as that, of just having that belief that was so critical to have. Now, I really didn't believe I was alcoholic when I came in here. I had no clue that this illness was going to be mine. And I'm grateful for the way we go at it. I tell you this, that, you know, being young really isn't a great asset. I was the youngest member in every meeting I ever attended. I was in the program for 2 years before I ever heard one single speaker with whom I identified. Not one. Everybody sounded different. Everybody was older than me. Most people had drunk 25 years longer than I was years old. And so I didn't identify. We can talk about identifying rather than comparing all we want to, but when you've got that kind of disparity in terms of drinking, you're gonna compare and you're gonna come out short. And so I didn't identify with people. I was extremely grateful. I tell you, the first guy I ever identified with in my life, and he's probably the worst example of who I might identify with, is the different anybody I ever met. There was a big old boy, and I've talked about him a million times, a big old boy named Lou from Detroit. And he was just kind of a just sort of a pasty guy, and a scared guy. And I think some guys from Detroit loaded him up and told him they were going on a cookout or something. I don't think they knew they were going to take him to a penitentiary. And when he came to his full senses, he was sitting in a maximum custody penitentiary, scaredest human I have ever seen in my life. Now, that guy, he spent the whole meeting kind of looking behind him to make sure nobody's sneaking up on him. And they finally coerced him, I mean coerced, into getting up to speak a little. You know, just share a little something. I don't remember his speech, but I remember what it sounded like. He was so scared he spoke in a falsetto. Voice just squeaked. And he was so glad to get done. I don't know if he got done, but he quit. And the first guy I ever identified with my life. Because he was a guy who demonstrated a fact that I truly believe. That alcoholism isn't defined by the circumstances of drunk. I don't think alcoholism is identified by how many times I've been to jail, hospitals, sanatoriums, wrong country, wrong state, married to a stranger. You know, I don't think it's measured by that. How many times I have my nose broke? Those are just circumstances of drunk. They happen. I don't think they define alcoholism. You know, and what this guy, the reason I identified with him, he didn't have any crazy war stories. He didn't have any circus acts to perform. What he was a guy who talked about being scared. He talked about fear. He talked about that dying on the inside. That's the hell of alcoholism. It's not what we exhibit, it's what we live when we die on the inside. And you feel the death of hope. And you live in quiet desperation. And you live in shame and remorse and guilt. And all of the stuff that we don't let anybody know, that we let keep drowned with booze. Yeah, that's the hell of it. That's why I identified with that guy. Yeah, I was very grateful. That was the first man in 2 years. I'm grateful for the way our book approaches. And I got a lot out of that. I've always been a reader, and it was extremely important to me when I got into the book, in the third chapter, where it talks about alcoholism, the illness, about things that really set the stage for me to be able to become a member. And I'm just highlight just a couple of those things. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learn, and I came perilously close to that as a young man. We learn that we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or generally may be has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control their drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. Now, those were words that were to become the centerpiece of my life. You know, I'm somebody who really, I know about illusion and delusion. That was what my life was about. I was a guy who lived in a world that looked as unreal to me as could possibly be. I was a guy who had the delusion of that I simply could not identify the troubles of my life with my drinking. You know, for example, what I'm talking about, how many times I would come to in the latest wreckage of the past, whatever it was. Like the time I came to married to that woman. I didn't even know the woman. I mean, at all. And I tried to get acquainted, ask her who she was. And she said she was Mrs. Ivester. That's a rude awakening. Rude awakening. I didn't mean to do that. She did. I mean, she didn't even drink. My God, I don't know what was wrong with her. Desperate, I think. But not desperate enough to keep what she got. So we had a wonderful 3-month marriage. And is that stupid or what? I mean, my God. That's just weird, the delusion. But now, that stuff, and waking up in that kind of mess, waking up in some blind pig, where a blind pig for the uninformed, that's a Detroit term. I don't know if it's gotten out to the rest of the world or not, but blind pigs is go where you're crazy enough to go when ain't nothing else open. And that's and blind pigs is where I'd often wake up in the latest mess of whatever I was in. And every time I would come to in that mess, yeah, my reaction would always be the same. You've done it again. You've done it again. And I never one time, identified my being where I was to taking the first drink. I never connected it. I never understood that there was something happened to me when I took a drink that I wound up like that. When I would come to, my thoughts would not be, you shouldn't have started drinking. My thoughts would be, you're no good. That pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization that goes with that would lead me to the conclusion that I'm just worthless, irresponsible, undisciplined, all of which had some truth in it. What I didn't know was that I'm the guy, if I take a drink, I can't predict what I'll do. And so, very important for me to start understanding alcoholism in something more than just how long you drank, or how many kind of wild and crazy acts you performed, that important for me to understand that this is about something that happens on the inside. And it doesn't matter if you're 24 or 84, that destruction is the same. And so it was those things, you know, where I started to listen a little bit of that, and thank God for the way it's treated in our book, where it gets away from that circus stuff and into the realities of what alcoholism is really about. There's a story in here that I want to visit just a little bit, because it's one of those things about, you know, when you get hold of this thing and you think it's going to last forever, you know, what is it that goes into losing it? And there's a story in there that is also a personal experience in there that I want to share. It's a story about a guy named Jim, who he was an interested man. He was 30 years old, a lot of spree drinking, very nervous in the morning after these bouts, quieted himself, more liquor, was ambitious to succeed in business, saw that he would get somewhere if he drank it all. Once he started, he had no control whatsoever. This is one, then I'll hit Jim. This is that notion. Some people think of alcoholism as that if you stop, the alcoholism continues and all that. The story of this story to me is the fact that it doesn't go anywhere. It's a permanent condition. And this guy, the businessman, once he started, he had no control whatsoever. He made up his mind that until he had been successful in business and had retired, he would not touch another drop. An exceptional man. He remained bone dry for 25 years and retired at the age of 55. After a successful and happy business career, then he fell into a belief which practically every alcoholic has, that this long period of sobriety, self-discipline, had qualified him to drink as other men. So he did. Out came the carpet slippers and the bottle. In 2 months, he was in a hospital, puzzled and humiliated. He tried to regulate his drinking for a while, making several trips to the hospital meantime. Then, gathering all the forces, he attempted to stop altogether and found he could not. Every means of solving his problem, which money could buy, was at his disposal. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man at retirement, he went to pieces quickly and was dead within 4 years. Yeah, there's a real story in it, a real point in that story to me, that alcoholism doesn't go anywhere. But what the book says is a powerful lesson, that the illness stays there. There's some notion that it continues to progress. But you know what the book says is that he, in no time, he started right where he left off. And, you know, what happens, I get older. You know, and, of course, things don't work exactly the same. But nothing works exactly the same. But it's a powerful lesson, that guy. And then there's another example of a guy that had a personal experience like this. There was a guy, Jim, and this fellow had good family and so forth. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. Had a commendable World War record, a good salesman. Everybody likes him, an intelligent man. Normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. I know about that. He did no drinking until he was 35. He's a slow learner. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us. Told him what we knew of alcoholism and the answer we had found. Made a beginning, his family was reassembled, and he began to work as a salesman for the business he had just lost. Hear what's happened to this fellow. Started to work for a business that he just lost through drinking. That's a tough adjustment. All went well for a time. Then he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. To his consternation, he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we worked with him, reviewing very carefully what had happened. He agreed he was a real alcoholic in serious condition. Knew he faced another trip to the asylum. If he kept on, moreover, he would lose his family for whom he had great affection. Yet he got drunk again. We asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. This is his story, and it's an interesting story of an alcoholic. I came to work on Tuesday morning. I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned. But it did. Had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. Decided to drive, this is alcoholic thinking. I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car. Good stuff. On the way, I was hungry, so I stopped at a place, just so happens, where they have a bar for a sandwich. I had no intention of drinking, of course. Just thought I'd get a sandwich. Also had the notion that I might find a customer for a car in this place, which was familiar, for I'd been going to it for years. I'd eaten there many times during the months I was sober. Sat down at a table, ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still no thought of drinking. Ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. Limit to how many of those you can have. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey, is this a drunk or what? If an inch of my milk, it wouldn't hurt me on a full stomach. I ordered a whiskey and poured it into the milk. Vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured as I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. The experiment went so well, I ordered another whiskey and poured it into more milk. That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another. And that started another journey, another asylum, and another commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing of the intense mental and physical suffering which was aware. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey. Well, it's a ludicrous story, isn't it? But a while back, I was up in a treatment center somewhere taking a fifth step with somebody. When I finished up, I was out in the hallway, and got a phone call. I made a phone call, and so I'm standing in the hall. You want to see a story come alive? I spotted a fella up in a casual area who happened to own probably the premier automobile agency in my town. And he was there with the telltale bracelet on his arm. Well, I got to make a decision. Do I give a little bit of courteous discretion and act like I don't see him? Or do I just sort of blunder on into his life? And I decided on the latter. And so He was trapped because where he was, he wanted to go to the other building. To do it, he had to walk by me. So I'm making a judgment call. Now, this is a dignified businessman from a high-class dealership. He started walking by, and I just reached. I knew him just enough to, not much, but I knew him enough to grab him. I just reached out and took his hand. And so he's standing there like a child, and I'm holding his hand while I finish my conversation. And he's standing there with his head hung down. And so when we got through, we talked a little. And when he went back, he wrote me a it was not a letter per se, it's like prose. He wrote kind of a prosaic message, and he called it The Hand in the Dark. And what he described was how meaningful that was, that somebody reached into the darkness of his life and gave him something to hang on to. That you don't know. I mean, nobody trains you how to work with alcoholics. If you've been there and you've got the experience, you know what to do. It's a God-given instinct. And you don't have to worry about it. We'll intuitively know how to handle situations. That fellow died sober. And wonderful thing. But every time I read that story, I think about that guy and a million other experiences that I've had. And so there were many, many things that interfered with this old boy getting going in the program. And those things of getting into that place where I knew at the depth of my being that I was alcoholic. That happened to me and got it to the period of finality in my fourth step. You know, the first three steps got me into, and it all combined got me into the thing where I knew I was in trouble with booze, but it was at an intellectual level. When I did that fourth step, it became depth to the pit of my soul. When I got through with that inventory, I knew without any question whatsoever that I'm alcoholic, period. Not the young guy, not the whiz kid. I'm alcoholic, period. And I'll tell you something, 50 years later, I have never doubted that for one second. Yeah, I think what happens when it goes deep like that, and where I truly, like it said a little earlier, I concede to my innermost self, I'm alcoholic. I have alcoholism. I'm not a bad drunk or a goofy drunk or a dangerous guy. You know, I'm the only danger to me are the offshoots of my illness, of what I do in the throes of my illness. But when I got to that point, I was done. I am deeply grateful for that because I believe what that does is gives me the long view of sobriety. I'm not somebody who worries about crisis because what this does is gives me the long view. I'm a guy who wants to stay sober for the rest of his life. And I can do that one day at a time if I use these tools and practice it as a way of life. And that was the thing that was resoundingly important for me to get to a point where I absolutely knew that I wanted something. And then I'm going to visit because my contract calls for second step. I'm going to visit. I'm such a fast talker that I just buzz through stuff so quick. But I'm going to visit it anyway because it was a critically important step for me. And I'm going to forego a bunch of the reading. I'm just going to share with you some what is it with this guy? You know, I'm a guy. As I mentioned earlier, I was a guy who was totally shut down on organized religion. I mean shut down. And I'm not talking about I had mild discomfort. I was somebody, if it had a cross on it, you wouldn't see me on that side of the street. I mean, I just flat cut, shut it out. And I wasn't angry. It was just that I just didn't buy into that and absolutely kept my distance. I promised when I got big enough to get away from Mama, have her quit dragging me to church, that I wouldn't go anymore and it wouldn't be bothered with me. I was sober in recovery for 11 years before I ever walked into a church. I'm a member of one now. I don't think they know it, but I we're Methodist, and The Methodists, we change, we do more rotation in the Methodist Church than AA does with our trusted service. And we rotate. By the time you get a minister trained, they move him somewhere. And it's always been amusing to me about most every time we change ministers, they come see me. Because they know the names on the book. But they come see me and they want to talk about, courteously, you know, about, well, it's sure nice to meet you and we know that you're in the fold, but we don't ever see you. I said, well, that's why I'm busy. And they always ask me what I do, and I always tell them that every Sunday, just about every Sunday, I'm doing something like you. It's a different deal, but I'm doing something like you. And I tell them what I do. I have never had a single one even pose a question. I've never had a single one do anything other than smile and say, keep on getting it, big guy. Keep on getting it, in whatever words they use. And so, you know, I have no real uneasiness about that. But that's who I was when I came here. Now, I was somebody who was not seeking a spiritual solution. I tolerated the fact that there happened to be one. I mean, they call this a spiritual program, but I swear to God, it looks awfully religious to a guy that's geared like me. I know when I walked into my first meeting, I was kind of braced because I figured they'd go into some kind of a religious celebration of some sort and burn candles and incense and smoke. And I knew it was coming. So I walk in gingerly. You know how you just kind of, it's like going swimming in cold water. I'm sort of tipping in because I'm thinking they're going to pounce on me any minute there and start laying on hands and stuff. And so I walked in and sat down. First thing we did was pray. Now, it wasn't a long St. Francis prayer. We got to that later. But it was just that little old serenity prayer that we opened so many of our meetings with. And now we close a lot with them, too. But that's what it did. Now, while they were praying, I was saying to myself, see there, I knew it. Here we go. Won't be any time for it. Deep, 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 deep dippings going on. And so I was really nervous. I read a bunch of stuff. It looked awfully religious to me. And so I was uneasy. Yeah, I had that, what they call, approach avoidance behavior. I knew it was a spiritual solution. I knew I was a guy in a lot of trouble. I knew I needed help. But I had an aversion to going to anything. If something said third step, you know, I'd be like the guy wanting to go see the crocodiles or something. You know, you want to go in there, but you don't want to get too close, you know. And so I would get drawn in, but I would be backing away at the same time. And so I was somebody who snuck up on that. And I am so grateful that our program says exactly what it does. Start where you are, not where you think you ought to be. Start where you are. And don't you have to explain it to anybody. Just like it said in what I read, find your own conception of God. That step gives great freedom, and with it, great responsibility. Because I've got to live with the choices I make. I'm grateful for that step. I'm grateful for it being exactly like it is. What that step says is, we came to believe. That clearly states a gradual process. We came to. We didn't suddenly discover. Some do. Not me. But we came to believe. What? That a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I'm not somebody who's an elocution engineer, and I'm not a word merchant, but I believe that the word "that" has enormous import in that step, because what it does is change it from a concept to an action, not just a belief that some global mystical cloud is over me, that there's something I believe in, but it's very specific. Come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Thank God for that. Thank God for that. The freedom and the responsibility to find the power that I can deal with. And I'll be ever grateful for that. That the first power that I ever believed in my life was the power that I sensed among the people in the first group to which I belonged. And that was the one in that penitentiary. I belonged to that group, And what I sensed in that group, and I'm not talking about collective power of a group. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a spirit that permeated and overrode that group that made us better than any of us were individually or collectively. There was something there. Part of what was convincing to me, I watched men who, by their own description, had committed acts of depravity and cruelty that defied imagination, and watched those self-same men become new people and become loving, caring folks who tended to other people. I learned how the power works by watching what the people who claim the power did. There was something I sensed in that group. Now, I couldn't describe it, and I still can't. But there was something that I sensed in that group that was stronger than all of us, that I, honest to God, believed could guide me into restoration to sanity. I believe that that power, as demonstrated in that group, could restore me to sanity. First prayer I ever said in my life, now lay me down to sleep, first intelligible prayer I ever said in my life was to a power that I couldn't have described to anybody. I still can't. I don't know how to describe God. I don't know how to do that. I don't care to. First power that I ever prayed to was that power that I felt. First prayer I ever had answered was from that power. And I'll let you in on a little secret. 50 years later, that power is not dramatically different. You know, that I'm not a ritual guy. I'm not somebody that's into a whole bunch of gyrations and stuff. You know, I'm somebody who practices a spiritual life on a daily basis, just like that little preface I read, that the steps are a group of principles which you practice as a way of life. I practice a spiritual life. You know, I've done the steps, I've done them many times, but I'm not a step mechanic. I practice a spiritual way of life as embodied in the steps. Every day of my life, unless I just am so cranky I forget it, but I try not to forget it. Every day of my life, I start out essentially the same way. And it's a simple deal. It's not a ritual because it'll come out differently. But I do three things. I do three basic elements of what I want to sort of practice my principles around. And what I do, and I love to do it at, my wife is here somewhere unless she's out sinning. She loves to sin. She may be out there losing the farm. I don't know. I'm a guy who loves running water. I mean, I just flat love it. Especially now in North Carolina, man, we are in a drought. I'd love to see some running water. But I love running water. I just love it. I love running waterfalls and a mountain stream that's just bubbling along. That's just an absolutely wonderful place. There's something kind of soothing and healing about that movement that goes up. So when I can, I wanted a pond in our yard, and my wife had no interest in a pond. She grew up in Saskatchewan, up in Canada, and a pond up there they'd think was a typhoon or something. I mean, ponds were not in vogue in Saskatchewan, so she had no interest in that, but I did. And so I gave her a pond for her 33rd wedding anniversary. She said, "Good try, big guy." But she actually, I mean, I'll let her feed the fish now. I wouldn't let her feed them for a while. I thought she'd poison them or something. But she kind of likes it now. She'll sneak out there one. But when I can, if it's not just too nasty, I'll go out there and sit down by that pond. And that's what my spiritual life's like. I go out, sit by the pond, and I'll watch the fish do their thing. You know, and they're just bumming around and doing what fish do. They don't really have a lot of... I read they only have a memory span of 3 seconds. God, life is never dull for them. It's always new. So they just wander around, bump into rocks and stuff. Can't remember where they are. Anyway, I watch them do that, and thank God I'm not a fish. They, and then I just, yeah, I let the running water do its work. I don't know about you, but I have a hard time shutting down my mind. I mean, that sucker is racing. Now, I know it's been well over 50 years since I sucked up a bunch of speed, but I swear, I believe it has lasting effect. I am a kinetic kind of guy, my God. So I sit down there, and I'm lines racing, and I'm working on the calendar, doing all kind of stuff. As I listen to that waterfall, and it just sort of takes it away. First thing you know, I start relaxing. And then when I get to a point where my mind is as clear as it's going to get, and I can focus, I ask my higher power to help me remember the absolute reality of who I am. And I'll guarantee you, this old boy has no illusions about who he is. I am a hopeless alcoholic. I am a guy who has a condition that I'm given to understand and do believe that 95% of the people on this earth who have it die of it. Those of us who find recovery are such an absolutely slim minority, it's barely measurable. We're a fraction of a percent of the alcoholic population. I'm one of them. I was given freedom in recovery from a condition that takes most people out, and I wasn't even looking for it. If it had been anybody handing it out on the basis of merit, I guarantee you I wouldn't have made muster. There's no way. And I've been given recovery, just freely given recovery from that hopeless condition. And I believe that. And so I thank my higher power for that gift. You know, I don't question why me. It's none of my business. My business is to take the gift and wear it well. And so the second thing I ask for when I feel properly appreciative and absolutely in touch with the reality of that, that's not some little song I sing. That's a feel that I want. And when I'm through with that, I ask my power to help me. If I'm so grateful, let me reflect it in the way I wear it. Let me reflect it in the way I conduct myself. Let me look like somebody who might even be remotely worthy of the gift, for God's sakes. Please help me not to be some crabby joker that's got no fun, no joy to share with anybody, to be discourteous and unthinking of people. Help me to wear it so that it looks like recovery is a good idea. A lot of people watch us, eh? I want to be somebody who makes recovery look attractive. I don't want people to say, my God, if it's this is what it's like, deliver me. No, I don't want to do that. I want to be careful how I conduct myself. I don't want to be praying one minute, my mouth sound like a running gutter the next. I want to be somebody who communicates the Spirit. That's a simple thing, eh? My God, is that much to ask for a guy who's been given a gift like this? It's my spiritual life. And then the third thing I ask for is to help me be sensitive to opportunities to be of service. To be sensitive to opportunity. If I don't sensitize myself, I'm like anybody else. I get caught up in life and I get caught up in demands. And the first thing you know, I'll walk right past opportunities and never even see it. Never see it. And you know, how incredibly unappreciative that is, eh? And so I want to be, and I'm not talking about doing a heart transplant to everybody I see. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about just a simple act of kindness. Simple act of kindness. Opportunity to be of service. I never go anywhere I don't have the opportunity. I fly all the time. I never make a flight I don't have an opportunity to be of service. No, never. I never go in a restaurant. I don't have an opportunity to be of service. I didn't goose them. But my wife was with me, so I know I didn't goose them. But I kind of just messed with a couple of gals where we had lunch. Would have messed with them where we had dinner, but I didn't get any. I guess so. I ain't messing with it if I don't get any dinner. But you see what I'm talking about? The opportunity to be of service. I'll just give you one example, right quick like. Then I got to quit. Close. I could give you a million. It's absolutely unbelievable of the things that happen. I'll give you a recent one. I was in my little town. I was walking by one day at some little strip mall place, and there was a fairly well-nourished lady, I'll put it that way, that was she was trying to load some stuff on a truck, and the barrels were almost big as her, and so I just happened to see it, since I'm sensitive to that, and I started walking, and I said, no, man, shoot. So I went over there, and I swear, when I walked up, she got in the position. She thought I was mugging her or something. So she got squared off, like, what do you want? And I said, those things look heavy. She said, they are. I said, let me help you. And she looked heavy, but you're not used to that. So we grunted over those barrels. She let me lift most of it, too, I'd have to say that. And, well, now that's no big deal, is it? Don't you suppose she had a better day? Don't you suppose I had a better day? That's what the spiritual life is. You know, this program, I said in the beginning, and I'm sure you remember all of that now, this program is about how to make me free and to make me be of useful service. It's not about me studying the nuances of recovery so that I can fine-tune my dialogue. That's not what it's about. It's about making these principles what I do. It's how I live. And a life, a recovery that does not have an active service life, for my money, is a recovery that is short-changed. A group of Alcoholics Anonymous that does not have an active service life outside the building is a group that's shortchanged. Because I think what you're going to hear about it from these guys when they get into it this weekend. What I've done is just sort of talked about the starting blocks, about what it is that we're launching at. All of those barriers that I mentioned, I'm not the only one here that has them. I don't care where you came from, you had the same kind of barriers. You might have had a different frame of reference for them. Well, we all have barriers to overcome. What our steps do is guide us through the elimination of those barriers. And the steps lead us through that. And that's what it does. It gives a new way of life. And the deal is that I can have a way of life where I do a lot of stuff, and I get back, God knows, I get back 10 times more than I give. I am looking forward to hearing my buddies for the rest of the weekend. Thanks.